called Disorder in Court. And I like it because it looks at humorous things that have been said, true stories, in court. Dumb questions lawyers have asked. And then even dumb or clever answers by people. For example, a lawyer asked one particular person, "What is your date of birth?" The person in the dock replied, "July 15th. "What year?" The person replied, "Why, every year." Or, the lawyer said, "What gear were you in at the moment of impact?" The person replied, "Sweater, jeans and Reeboks." Gear, slang for clothes, of course. Or, the lawyer said, "How old is your son, the one living with you?" 38 or 45, I can't remember which. "How long has he lived with you?" "Why, 45 years," said the person in the dock. Or, the lawyer said, "What was the first thing your husband said to you when you woke up that morning?" He said, "Where am I, Kathy? And why did that upset you?" And the wife replied, "Because my name is Susan." Or, one of my favourites, the lawyer said, "All your responses must be oral, okay?" The person in dock replied, "Oral." Or some of these stupid, these one-liners to some stupid questions. "The youngest son, the 20-year-old, how old is he?" Or, "Were you present when your picture was taken?" Well, from the ridiculous to the more important and the more significant. And we're looking this morning at one of the great trials throughout history. And today's passage is twofold. It is the trial of Jesus and what we call the denial of Peter, and they're kind of woven together. And we read, didn't we, in verse 53, these words: "They took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, elders, teachers of the law came together." All the religious leaders of the Jewish people were there to form this incredible court. Peter followed at a distance. All the disciples fled except for two, Peter and John. They followed from a distance. And Peter takes centre stage in Mark's gospel. He seems to get a little bit closer and isolated. There he sat with the guards and warmed himself at a fire. And we're going to look at the trial of Jesus first, when he was arrested. Shortly after, he was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, and then shortly this trial took place. And in the next 12 hours from his arrest, six different trials he faced. That's right, six different trials in 12 hours before being crucified the following noon. Many Bible dictionaries or commentaries give the order of events, but we believe between the hours of 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. he was taken before Annas, he was taken before Caiaphas, he was taken before the Sanhedrin. Those were the Jewish courts he went to. And then he went to Pilate, to Herod, and to Pilate again. So he went to three Jewish courts and three Roman courts before a verdict was passed. None of the Gospels give us the six orders chronologically. You have to get them all together and you can puzzle it out. But most Bible commentaries do that for you, or you can look on the web and they'll give you the order of the six trials Jesus experienced. This morning in Mark's Gospel, we're introduced to trial number two. Jesus has already been to Annas and he sent him to this man called Caiaphas, and we'll find out about him in a minute. He's on trial, but it's in what we might call a kangaroo court. Now, a kangaroo court is a mock court in which principles of law and justice are disregarded or they're perverted. You see, under Jewish law, you couldn't meet at night time. You had to meet in the daytime. But this court is completely wrong because they're meeting in the early hours of the morning at night time. Secondly, they should not be in the home of Caiaphas. They should be in the court building. So that is wrong again. Thirdly, this is a closed affair. Just the religious leaders. Jewish courts were to be open affairs. There should be reporters present, and all that's missing. So they have quickly made an illegal kangaroo court to try Jesus. Now let's look at some of the characters involved. There are five parts of the puzzle. five different groups or individuals in the story. Number one, we have Caiaphas. Who was he? He was the high priest, and we read about him in verse 53. Joseph Caiaphas, high priest of the temple between the years AD 18 and AD 37. His job was to be a representative on behalf of the people. The job of the priest was to listen to the people and help them get right with God. That was the job of a priest. A prophet was the opposite. A prophet listened to what God had to say and then spoke to the people. But a priest was different. He listened to the people and then he brought their prayers and petitions, or he represented them before God. And once a year as high priest, he had to go into what was called a special part of the temple, the Holies of Holies. Only he was allowed to go, and only once a year. And he made a sacrifice on behalf of the people. The rest of his time was taken up in what we might call routine ministry. He was in charge of the temple treasury. He controlled the temple police, all the other ranking priests and attendants, and he ruled over the Sanhedrin. We'll discover who they were in a minute. Now, Caiaphas had been in his position for 19 years. Normally, you hold that position for 2 years. How come he lasted 19 years? Mainly because he got on well with the Romans. And historians all speak badly of this man. He was a double dealer, one thing to the Jews and then one thing to the Romans. He took the Roman dollar and influenced the Jewish people. So he held his position because he was a wily politician. Secondly, not only do we have Caiaphas in the picture, but we have this court called a Sanhedrin, which means nothing to us in our Western ways. Verse 55. The Sanhedrin was the supreme council or court in ancient Israel. It was composed of 70 men, plus the high priest, who headed it. So 71 people met in the Sanhedrin. The membership was made up of chief priests, scribes and elders, although no one actually knows how they got to be part of that court. And they were a court that had power in every aspect: legislative, executive, judicial, civil, criminal and ecclesiastical, things to do with the church or religion, power in the land. But they had a big problem. They had all this power. They'd already decided this man Jesus must die. He doesn't play by our rules. He's dangerous. We want to get rid of him. But because the Romans had invaded and they ruled the land, they had no power to put someone to death. That's why when they decided to kill Jesus, they had to come up with a false charge that would let the Romans make the decision to execute him. The Romans wouldn't kill him because of blasphemy, because he claimed to be God in the flesh. So they tried to trump up another charge that would persuade the Romans, this man needs killing. So you have Caiaphas, you have the Sanhedrin. Like I say, already made their minds up, this man must die. They remind me of the Indian tribe who, one day a doctor showed the Indians that the reason they kept getting sick is they were drinking the contaminated water. And they looked at the water and they said, it looks clean to us. So the doctor got a microscope and he got a slide and he put a drop of water on and he put it under the microscope and he lined the people up, and one by one they looked through the microscope so they could see the contamination. Never seen one before. All of a sudden, a whole new world opened up before their eyes. That night, while the doctor was sleeping, somebody broke into his apartment, got the microscope and smashed it. Now for that tribe, the problem was solved. Get rid of the microscope, you can't see the germs, there aren't any germs. Life goes on as before. But you and I know it did nothing to alter the truth. And the Pharisees, the Sanhedrin are like that. Get rid of Jesus and the problem's solved. No, it's not, it's still there. Only you're unaware of it. So they need to get rid of Jesus, but they can't unless they can think of a law that the Romans will say serious enough to carry out the sentence of crucifixion. The third key in the puzzle are the witnesses in verse 56 to 59. Many testified falsely against him, But their statements did not agree. Then some stood up. Under Jewish law, for example, in the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 17 verse 6, in a court of law, you needed two unanimous witnesses. If you didn't have two witnesses, a person couldn't be tried. And he certainly couldn't be found guilty of death. Now, the Sanhedrin had many more than two witnesses. The fact they're so readily available in the early hours of the morning is an indication that this was a kangaroo court and they'd got their witnesses all lined up and ready to go. Problem is, they didn't have enough time to prepare their evidence. And they were unable to get their story straight. And they contradicted one another. And so what do you do when witnesses contradict one another? You say, hey, these are false witnesses. We can't hold their evidence. This man must be released. Not on this occasion. Despite the fact they contradict one another, their evidence is still accepted at the expense of the truth. And it's tragic, isn't it, that you've got a group of religious leaders who are encouraging people to lie. That in itself is bad, but they're doing it in the holy season, at the time of Passover, which makes it doubly bad. Priests, religious leaders, should be an example of honesty and truth. And these are the very opposite. They are plotting deceit and even murder. Fourthly, in the puzzle of this trial, we have Jesus himself. Verses 60 to 61. The high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. Why didn't he answer? Well, I think there are two reasons. First, the charges were false. Everyone knew it. So as far as Jesus was concerned, there was no case to answer. Whatever he said, they wouldn't believe. So why waste your breath? So he remained silent. But actually, there is a deeper reason. Jesus, we're told, realized that this trial and the other trials were all part of a bigger plan. We call it God's plan of salvation. The very reason he'd come. He knew from his very birth, all the way through his childhood, he had one reason to be in here on planet Earth, and that was to die. There's a great picture by a man called Holman Hunt. He was a Raphaelite painting. Now, I don't know what that means, but it always sounds impressive, doesn't it? A Raphaelite painting. He painted some famous pictures. One was Light of the World. Everyone knows that. But he painted another picture of Jesus as a boy. And it's called The Shadow of the Cross. And the picture of Jesus in a boy is Jesus in his dad's workshop as a teenager. And he's kind of planing a piece of wood and he stops. And it's late at night and it's hot and it's sweaty and the candle's burning and the sweat's pouring off him. And he stops and he kind of wipes his brow and he just stops to yawn. And as he yawns with his arms stretched out, before him is a shadow of the cross. And of course that picture's symbolic because it's a reminder all throughout the life of Jesus. He knew the cross was coming. It wasn't an accident. It was part of a plan. And even at the baby himself, they brought three gifts. Frankincense, myrrh, gold. Gold because he was a king. Incense because he was a priest. It would help people discover God. But myrrh was a burial spice. Why did you give a baby full of life burial spice? A reminder, here's one who was born to die. You and I were born to live. This baby was born to die. And so Jesus didn't defend himself for the very reason he was coming. He had a destiny with the cross. And hundreds of years before, and we sang those words in one of our songs, didn't we? Isaiah, a prophet of God, gave a message to the people. And in that message he said these words. He, talking about the Messiah to come, Jesus, will be led like a lamb to the slaughter. In other words, he's not going to violently resist. But just like a lamb goes meekly to the slaughterhouse, Jesus went meekly to the cross. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter. As a sheep before her shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. Those very words are being fulfilled in that courtroom. Caiaphas, panicking, realizing that his witnesses are useless and have no testimony, decides to grasp the nettle to force the issue. We're told he puts Jesus under an oath. Mark doesn't tell us that, but Matthew does. If you look in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 26 and verse 63, under oath he requires Jesus to speak. And under oath, Jesus responds. He tells the truth. And the question is, who are you, Jesus? And Jesus replies, I am the Son of Man. Now, to you and I, Son of Man just sounds like a nice title. But if you were Jewish, 2,000 years ago, it was a significant title. It meant you were claiming to be the Messiah, the Christ. In fact, when Jesus replies, he quotes two parts of the Old Testament, the Jewish Bible. He quotes Psalm 110, verse 1, which we're going to look at tonight in our evening service, and Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. He gives them a two-pronged answer. And Caiaphas and all those knew exactly what he was saying, what he was claiming. With our Western minds, we don't understand it. But he tells them two things. Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? I am, said Jesus. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One. In other words, Jesus says, I may stand before you now in chains, but one day you will stand before me in judgment. Secondly, he said, sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One, coming on the clouds of heaven. Jesus again says, you may be judging me, but a time comes when I shall judge you. The right hand is the position of power and honor in the Jewish world. For Caiaphas, it's all too much. He grabs his clothes and he tears them. Again, that was a Jewish way of saying, this man has committed the ultimate sin, blasphemy. He must die. We have all the proof we know for. We have all the proof we're looking for. We don't need to carry on with this trial. Verse 65 says, they took him out, they spat upon him, they mocked him, they beat him. Now, while all that is going on, something else is happening just outside the wall, in the courtyard. That's happening in the building. Something parallel is happening in the courtyard. And that's our fifth piece of the puzzle. Our fifth character, Simon Peter. Peter, of course, was called by Jesus to be a fisherman. Jesus said, from now on, forget fish, you're going to catch people. He became a disciple. He was the unofficial spokesman for the disciples. He had a forceful personality, which was his strong point, but also his weakness. Peter was chosen by Jesus, along with James and John, to see things that no one else was allowed to see. He took them as an exclusive group of three into situations. And Peter, of course, started life as Simon. And he changed his name to Peter. Why? Because Peter has a new meaning. He changed his name to Mr. Dependable. Well, that's my translation of it. He changed his name to Peter the Rock. Just like a rock is solid and immovable, Peter, you're going to be solid and immovable. In fact, with you and my other disciples, I'm going to build my church. And here's Mr. Dependable doing the very opposite of what his name suggests. Panicking and letting Jesus down. Three times in this courtroom, Peter is accused of knowing Jesus. Now, I believe Peter was dependable and he would go on to be Mr. Dependable. But here he's acting out of context. Why? Well, remember, he is physically weary. Even when they were in the Garden of Gethsemane, which you looked at last week, he couldn't stay away during the prayer meeting. He fell asleep. These disciples are physically shattered. They've been on an emotional roller coaster. They've seen highs and lows, and now their leader, the one they've decided to follow, they've given up everything to follow him, is arrested, and the whole world is collapsing. He's in a state of shock. He doesn't respond like he would do in the calm of a normal day. He acts out of character. And three times, verse 67, a little girl looks at him and says, you look familiar. you were with that Jesus, weren't you? Although, did you notice what she said mockingly? You were that Galilean, that Nazarene. Contempt in her words. And Peter said, no, I wasn't. And then in verse 69, he escapes from the courtyard and he hides in a passageway. And the same servant girl walks by and says, no, you were with him. We saw you. And again, Peter says, I'm not one of them. And then in verse 70, the bystanders, listening to his Galilean accent, because you realise all the disciples were northerners, don't you? And Jesus was. They all spoke with northern accents. Sorry about that, Yusuf. There was only one southerner, but you better not mention him. So as soon as Peter starts talking, it's like listening to a Geordie or a Scouser or a Mancunian. He's got an accent. And they say, you're definitely with him. We can tell by the way you speak. And he swears and curses and says, I don't know this man. Three times he's accused. Three times he denies. And verse 72 is one of those sad verses of the Bible. Immediately the cock crew a second time. Peter went out and he wept. Actually, there's a little bit Mark doesn't include, but Dr. Luke in his gospel does. Because Jesus was on trial inside the building and Peter was in the courtyard, Dr. Luke says that actually they had eye contact. Whether it was through a window or a passageway or a door, we don't know. But Jesus turned and looked at Peter. That's what broke his heart more than anything. When he realised he'd let down his master and Lord. Wouldn't it be tragic to stop at that point? To wipe Peter out of history. Failure. Loser. When you needed Mr. Dependable, where was he? But don't rush over those words. Immediately the cock crowed a second time. We have a proverb, a phrase, don't we? Every cloud has a silver lining. And you might read these words and say, well, apart from situations like this. No. Every cloud has a silver lining. And although the cock crowing was Peter's darkest moment, it also gave him a silver lining. Why? Because Jesus had told him these things would happen. This is not circumstances out of control. This is the plan of salvation being executed. Why a silver lining? Well, the cock crowing is an announcement. What does the cock crow in the morning? It's an announcement of a brand new day. The old is past, the new is here. Peter, in the past, shamefully, in the darkness of night, failed his master. But with a new day came a new opportunity. Let me finish just by contrasting Peter and Judas, two men who both failed Jesus. Judas admitted his sins, but he never confessed them. He never repented of them. That's why he hung himself. Peter wept over his sins. He's sorry for the situation. Judas experienced remorse, Peter repentance. There's a big difference, isn't there? Between feeling sorry and actually wanting to change the situation and change yourself. When Judas left the upper room to betray Jesus, we're told it was night. It is a dark symbolic picture. No hope. When Peter fails, it's the dawning of a new day. There is light coming. For Judas, it was a deliberate betrayal. He cared about money more than the master. But for Peter, it was a temporary mistake, a blunder, a failing in his walk as a disciple. And that's why, later on, Jesus would find Peter and three times give him the opportunity to put right his denials. Three times he could say, Peter, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? So although it's a tragic, sad situation, there is hope and purpose. In those simple words, the cock crowed the second time. Well, someone else is going to pick up the ball and run with it as we look at Mark chapter 15 next week. But it's good to remind our hearts that the trial of Jesus, and ultimately the death of Jesus, not circumstances out of control, God's plan of salvation, and that on the cross, in those 3 hours of darkness. Why darkness? I think it was so that people couldn't pry in. Something mysterious supernatural was taking place. And the Bible puts it this way: God would make him, Jesus, who knew no sin, born of the Virgin Mary, perfect, to be sin for us, so that you and I could make an exchange. He could take our sin, and we could take his forgiveness, his righteousness, his cleansing. That's the message of Christianity, isn't it? The Christian message is this: that by trusting in the death of Jesus, there is forgiveness. By looking to the risen Jesus, there is power in our daily living. And looking forward to the coming Jesus, there is hope for the future. If you haven't got that hope, let me encourage you to think about these things. I'm not dashing off, more than happy to chat. There's plenty of literature and DVDs in the foyer. Do help yourself. And let me encourage you to come next week and discover more as Arthur Sarway looks at chapter 15. Let's pray together.